At its Investor Day this morning, Dow will outline a new plan to boost operating profits by $3 billion. The company will also reiterate its 2050 carbon neutrality commitment. Let's get a behind-the-scenes look at this plan with Dow President and CFO Howard Ungerleider. Howard, good to see you as always here. Thanks for coming on. That is a big number, $3 billion in additional operating profits. What's the timeline on achieving that, and how do you get there?
Well, thanks a lot for having me, Brian. It's great to be back here on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. You know, we were last back here 3 years ago as we were getting ready to spin out the new Dow from DowDuPont. In the last 3 years, we've uplifted the earnings of the entire enterprise by $2 billion a year over the economic cycle. And Team Dow has delivered top quartile performance in cash flow conversion, in cost structure, in net debt reduction, and in shareholder remuneration. And as you pointed out with that question, what we're here today to talk about is the next several years, and that's $3 billion of additional uplift in earnings over the economic cycle. To answer your question, we'll see $2 billion of that, more than $2.5 billion of that over the next several years through 2025. And then the big announcement this morning is our first ever net zero carbon emission site in Alberta, Canada, where we're going to be decarbonizing the entire site and growing the earnings of that site. And we'll be doing that. That'll RTO in 2027 in first phase, and then 2029 in the second phase.
Pardon me, Howard, it's Julie here. RTO, in my world, that's return to office, but I think that's not what you mean here.
Ready to operate or return to
ready
operation.
To operate.
Sorry.
Okay, that's okay. All right.
Good to see you, Julie.
Good to see you too. How does that work? In other words, how do you make a chemical plant? You guys, as you said, making ethylene there. How does it operationally get to zero carbon emissions?
Yeah, so we're doing it primarily with an autothermal reformer and carbon capture. So basically, we've got an existing hydrocarbon cracker on the site today. As a part of this investment, we will be building a brand new world scale cracker at that site as well. So it's a brownfield investment, lower risk, a higher return on invested capital project. And then connected to the cracker, we will put an autothermal reformer. What that autothermal reformer does is take off gas or waste gas from both crackers, turns it into hydrogen, and then that hydrogen will go back into the process. So we'll close the loop, and then we also will join the Alberta trunk line. Carbon capture has been a capability in Alberta for quite a while. So we'll take carbon capture and capture any of the carbon and then sequester and store that carbon. So that'll allow us to get probably 95% of the carbon off of the site, and then we'll do the rest either with alternative energy and or some offsets to close the gap from the 95% to the 100% to really make it a net zero emission site and the first ever net zero emission site around the world.
Howard, two of your largest investors are in fact Vanguard and BlackRock. They own collectively about 14% of your shares. You know, what are those meetings like now with these companies, both of which I would say are very focused on ESG?
Yeah, I mean, look, they're great. They're great investors. They've been with us for the long haul, and I think you're exactly right. I mean, certainly all the conversations that we have every quarter, the ESG component of it continues to increase. You know, we build though on a track record of strength. So we've set 10-year sustainability goals for now 3 decades. And we're in our 18th year of annual sustainability reporting with our intersections report that we just published several months ago. And to your point about in the open, our 2050 goals, right? So we set the 2050 goal to be carbon neutral across the entire enterprise. And then we set the interim goal to take another 15% of our carbon emissions down by 2030, and that's on a 2020 basis. And that builds on the first 15% reduction that we've already achieved from 2005 to 2020. And we've been able to do all of that reduction while we've also been increasing the earnings power of the company.
Howard, let's talk feedstock, shall we? In other words, the stuff that you guys use to make your products. As we've been talking about, commodity prices right now have been hot. We've seen oil prices go higher, natural gas prices go higher, et cetera, et cetera. How are you guys managing that? Are you raising your prices? How far out are you buying, for example? What are you doing?
Well, we're doing all of the above. I would say one of the benefits that we have as Dow is we've been investing in feedstock flexibility, literally asset by asset, furnace by furnace around the world. So we have the ability to crack different kinds of natural gas, whether it's the U.S. shale advantage or whether it's the Alberta project that we just talked about. That Alberta advantage is also a structural advantage and has been in place for probably 5 decades. We also are a major player in Bahía Blanca, Argentina, with gas there out of the Vaca Muerta shale fields. And then, of course, we have our investments in the Middle East as well. But feedstock flexibility is key. Obviously, we're dealing with inflation that almost everybody in every market sector is. And so we're no different. We are working to raise our prices to at least compensate for some of that higher feedstock cost. But on a relative basis, we are in a very good position because of that feedstock flexibility and our geographic diversity of our production.
Howard, yeah, to your point, I mean, inflation is really, it's sticking around and it's proving anything but transitory. The main, I would say, ingredient, if you will, and everything you do really is hydrocarbons. It is oil-based. You know, how concerned are you about this latest push higher in oil prices and your ability to forecast your business?
You know, well, I think, look, the reality is everything has got some inflation, to your point. And I agree with your point that it doesn't feel very transitory at the moment. I mean, the reality is we came off of the pandemic where basically most of the industrial economy and the consumer economy shut down. And now the demand has snapped back much faster than pretty much everybody has predicted. And as a result, you know, if we could produce more, we could definitely sell more. So, you know, we're doing our best that we can to try to drive that supply growth. And then you manage it customer by customer, market by market, application by application. But I feel really good about the markets that we serve. So we participate today in about $650 billion worth of market opportunity. And the markets that we participate in, whether it's packaging, infrastructure, home and personal care, or mobility, these are markets that are growing 1 to 1.5 times GDP. So by 2025, that'll be north of $800 billion of market opportunity. So significant amount of growth potential for us.
I'll tell you, Howard, the split seems like yesterday. Good to see you down there at the New York Stock Exchange. Dow President and CFO Howard Ungerleiter, have a great rest of the day. With the return to offices delayed for many due to the pandemic and yields on the rise, the REIT sector could be in the spotlight very soon. Let's dive in with J.P. Morgan senior analyst and co-head of U.S. real estate stock research, Tony Pallon. Tony, good to see you this morning here. So for those not necessarily too familiar or invested in the REIT space, historically, what has happened to the sector when rates rise as they have over the past month?
Yeah, so it's a good question, Brian. So if we don't have a lot of examples because interest rates have been going down for such a long time, but you know, one example was the taper tantrum, where you had a pretty hard and fast move in rates that surprised the market. And during that period of time, the REITs did take a hit. We were down about 15% over the course of, say, 4 months and underperformed the market in that instance. So I think there's a lot of focus on that as an example of the risk to the group right now. But from our vantage point, we do think there's some key differences where that doesn't necessarily have to be the case this time, because there's a lot of other good things that are happening across commercial real estate right now.
I would also ask, Tony, hey, it's Julie here, what the debt load is of REITs in aggregate now compared to historical levels. And I imagine the debt servicing costs, even if rates go up another 25 bips, for example, that it's still going to be relatively low for these guys.
Yeah, from a capital stack point of view and thinking about the debt and the debt loads of these companies, that's really a non-issue from where we sit. The leverage levels for REITs run approximately 30% of total real estate value. So these are pretty low leveraged vehicles as it relates to commercial real estate. When you go to the private market and you see participants buying commercial real estate assets, the leverage level is typically about double that. So from that vantage point, the companies are in very good shape. The interest rate risk from our vantage point has more to do with whether or not it prompts investors to seek other parts of the market and sell stocks that have been historically geared towards more income-oriented investors. That's the bigger risk to us. We're not too worried about the capital stacks themselves. In fact, what you're seeing across the group right now is balance sheets that are in good enough shape to see broad-based transaction activity. So being able to use balance sheets to drive growth through investing has actually been a positive for the group.
Tony, it does appear that we're going to stay in this hybrid work environment for some time to come. How does that change the earnings power of the REIT sector looking out over the next 5 years?
Yeah, well, we think it's a headwind for the office business, clearly. And we can all debate about whether 5% of people work from home or 50% of people work from home. There will be some amount of it that happens. We do think it will be some amount of a headwind to demand for office space. So we think the office business is most at risk naturally from this shift in the way people work. So our view has been to de-emphasize office stocks, but there is a really interesting way we think to invest in the theme broadly, and that is through the commercial real estate service companies, where they're going to have a seat at the table here to help occupiers manage their space, whether they want more or less of it. And they're going to get paid commissions and advisory fees, almost irrespective of how the world ends up playing out from a space point of view. They're going to be in the mix helping occupiers and landlords with space decisions. And we think that's the way you invest in the shift in what's happening in workplace usage.
And Tony, is Jones Lang LaSalle an example of that, that you're trying to play the servicing side of the business?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's our top idea right now. We think that's a company, it's the number two commercial real estate services platform in the world. And you've got the ability to drive earnings growth over the next few years through the return of transaction activity, both investment sales, which have been effectively doubling on a year-over-year basis, and the return to more normalized leasing activity. Going back to this office idea, through the pandemic, a lot of office leasing decisions have been delayed, and companies, again, still need to figure out precisely what they want to do with their space over time. Those deals will happen, and as they return to more normal levels of leasing activity and making those decisions day-to-day, JLL and really their peers, for that matter, will be at the table earning commissions and helping those transactions. So we think there's a lot of runway to go from the leasing side. You're seeing investment sales activity really move higher. You're back above 2019 levels on that front. And so that's driving a lot of growth right now. And then the company has a very strong balance sheet that gives them the ability to go invest as well and drive other parts of their business. So we think it's broadly a very good setup for a company like that on the asset light side, as opposed to being the office landlord.
Hey, Tony, one quick sort of side note on JLL. It's selling its China real estate management unit. And it's interesting, anything that puts the words China and property or real estate in the same sentence right now, I think is getting increased scrutiny. Is there any risk here that the deal doesn't happen, then it's stuck with this real estate management unit at a time when property-wise things in China are, I don't know, a little bit challenged, one could say?
Yeah, it's possible. But from our vantage point, thinking about JLL as a stock and as a company, that region and that specific business line within the region is very small. So whether they sell it or not, it's frankly going to probably be a rounding error from an earnings point of view. And that's also the reason why it was, or potentially may be sold. So I think when they looked back at that business, the customer base didn't necessarily line up with what they were trying to achieve globally. And it wasn't particularly sizable for them as a company. And so, we'd like to see the sale go through because it could be capital coming in that could be redeployed into something more strategic for the company. But if it doesn't happen, it's not big enough from our vantage point to move the needle from an investing point of view in JLL.
Real good insight here. JP Morgan senior analyst and co-head of U.S. real estate stock research, Tony Pallone. Good to see you. Enjoy the rest of the week.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. There has been a big fit and start when it comes to boosters. Of course, the Biden administration really pressing full steam ahead. And now reports of medical professionals jumping in to maybe push back a little bit when it comes to being so enthusiastic about getting everyone booster shots and whether or not they're necessary when it comes to really trying to prevent what this whole thing was all about and reducing transmission and avoiding hospitalizations and, of course, death. And for more on that, happy to welcome back into the show one of the experts we love chatting with on the show, Dr. Michael Sagg, University of Alabama at Birmingham, Associate Dean for Global Health, joins us here. And Dr. Sagg, I mean, when we talked about boosters, of course, there was no reason not to be all in when it comes to getting those out if you believed that this was going to really help in reducing transmission and whether or not they're necessary. But what do you make of maybe some of the pushback now around some professionals saying they might not be all that necessary?
Yeah, I think the operative word in your question there, Zach, is believe. So we're a little bit into a faith-based as opposed to evidence-based realm here. The reason for that is simple. We did all the things we had to do appropriately to get these vaccines tested, and lo and behold, they worked, and we got them out into people's arms very, very fast. That has saved hundreds of thousands of lives worldwide and well over 140,000 lives in the United States just in the first 5 months. What we couldn't do, because there wasn't time, was to look at the durability that we had to do. We have to do that on the fly. That's just by definition. It's the way things are. So we have to ask the public to be patient as we work through this. We just don't know how often a booster will be needed or who it will be needed in or how often. And that's really what we're watching unfold. So, of course, there's going to be debate and there's going to be, I wouldn't even call it controversy. I think it's just debate on finding the right thing to do. And I think it's pretty clear that at least for the Pfizer vaccine, waiting for people who are over 65 and especially those who are immunocompromised, yes, they should get a booster. The rest of us should just wait a little bit, let the data sort itself out.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the interesting thing here, too. I mean, when we look at the data, obviously, it's still overwhelming when it comes to the safety and efficacy of vaccines for people who are still unvaccinated. So that's kind of out the door. That's one that we don't even need to talk about here. But when we're talking about boosters themselves, a new study looking at the efficacy of the Pfizer vaccine after the second dose did show a bit of a waning of efficacy, down from 88% effective to 47% effective 6 months after that second dose. So, I mean, I guess that would seem to indicate that there is a need for booster shots. It's just kind of splitting hairs when you come into when exactly and for who.
Well, yeah, we need to get in the weeds on that a little bit. You quoted the data accurately, and when you say efficacy, what you're talking about is prevention of a breakthrough infection. What's the other story in that study is that there were no deaths to speak of. There still was protective against hospitalization and death. And at the end of the day, that's what we want the vaccine to do. It'd be wonderful if it prevented infection 100%. There's no vaccine that we have that does that, especially look at flu. In an ordinary flu season, about half the people who have had a flu vaccine will get the flu. But the vaccine protects them against hospitalization and to some degree death. And so that's really what we're looking for. So part of the debate that you referred to in the first question takes the data you just quoted into account and then asks the question, what are we going to focus on here for efficacy? Is it breakthrough prevention of that, or is it going to be prevention of hospitalization and death? And I think that's the controversy right now.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's important, too, to kind of reiterate there when we talk about vaccines, what we're trying to do. And you know, it's weird because at the beginning of all this, you had people kind of, and I don't want to get into the politics of it, but you had some people angry at others for calling it the flu. It's now kind of evolved to where the people who were on the other side are now calling it the flu, but only because we've moved into the area where we do have vaccines to manage all this. So it's kind of strange. There is still, of course, though, still the outrage, I suppose we can call it, when it comes to, you know, the ideas of lockdown are returning to some of the more draconian measures we saw. Dr. Fauci kind of walked that back when it came to Christmas. I know I've talked to you. Crazy to think how long it's been. Last year when we were talking about Thanksgiving and Christmas. This time around, what do you think that the messaging should be there? Because we saw the CDC pull a 180 and take down their guidance for the holidays. Dr. Fauci, as I said, kind of walking it back. What should people be thinking about when it comes to gathering again for a second holiday season in a pandemic?
Well, you also hit it on the head again in terms of what's different this year than last year is that a lot of people have been vaccinated, and that's going to keep people relatively safe in terms of severe disease and will prevent roughly half of the infections conservatively. So my personal view is that I think we can think about gathering with small groups of family, especially if your people in your family have been vaccinated. The one thing, as you alluded to, the deaths that we're seeing right now, the hospitalizations, the ICUs, is overwhelmingly among people who are not vaccinated. So if you're not vaccinated, you should be careful. It's still out there and you can get infected. And once you get infected, the cascade starts and you don't have control over where that disease takes you. For people who are vaccinated and are up to speed, I think we can start to relax a little bit. But one thing we've learned in this whole epidemic is that we can't predict it very well. Why? Because it's new. We don't have any history to go on. We model based on other diseases, like you said, flu, but it's not the flu. It's something else. And we're learning as we go. We've only been a year and a half into that. It feels like over a decade and a half because of the pain that it's caused and the death and the destruction. But we only have a year and a half. So prognosticating is very difficult. As Yogi Berra said, predictions are difficult, especially they involve the future.
Yeah, always. But we always love having you on here to chat because it's data-driven, it's fact-driven, and it's always measured and true. Dr. Michael Sack, appreciate the time again. University of Alabama at Birmingham, Associate Dean for Global Health. Come back soon. I want to turn to kind of a larger discussion around the regulatory front here. As we've seen, of course, SEC Chair Gary Gensler is one man. There are other commissioners to take into account here, as we did last week. Hester Peirce joining us for a little bit, talking about her dissatisfaction with the way that the SEC has been dragging their feet when it comes to regulating crypto. Take a listen of just a piece of our discussion from last week.
It is disconcerting to me that for 3 years now, I've been asking for regulatory clarity, and we can't seem to provide any. And so I think this is really becoming a huge barrier to this industry being able to develop in a way that's safe, but also in a way that allows innovation to happen. And it's a real shame to me that we are not just taking up the mantle as regulators to develop a regulatory framework.
So joining us now to broaden out the discussion on what the regulations look like when it comes to crypto, happy to welcome back in to the show, Perianne Boring, Chamber of Digital Commerce founder and president, here with us once again. And Perianne, I mean, when we look at it, you know, you heard there from Commissioner Peirce talking about the need for regulation. It sounds like Congressman Patrick McHenry was really backing that take in this safe harbor bill that would kind of let companies not be afraid of the SEC cracking down on when it comes to raising funds and creating more guardrails for companies to follow. I mean, you've been watching the way that this has evolved for quite some time. What do you make of the progress in regulations coming out of DC now?
Yeah, well, I absolutely love that Commissioner Peirce joined the interview from her car. It's truly a testament to how hard she has been working as an advocate for the blockchain space. And she's absolutely right. We do not have clear, defined regulations on when a digital asset is a security and when it is not. This is not just me saying this. Hester Peirce has said this. And we also have, I would guess there's about 30 members of Congress who have either sponsored or introduced legislation to address this very issue. So because the SEC has failed to give the industry the clarity that it needs, Congress is now stepping in. And we saw that again yesterday. Ranking member of the House Financial Services Committee, Patrick McHenry, introduced a bill that would create a safe harbor for digital tokens, and it mirrors the proposal that Hester Peirce has developed. She also has a safe harbor, but the SEC has yet to bring that forward for rulemaking. We are continuing to urge them to do so, and Congress is now stepping into the conversation.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, a lot of it speaks to how quickly this stuff moves. Obviously, DC doesn't move that fast, so they're kind of catching up in what's really going on here. And I guess, you know, you might have people watching this all play out and say, all right, Bitcoin and Ethereum got to that kind of promised land of not being seen as a security. There's promise that some of these other projects might be able to do the same as well. But it's a very important distinction when it comes to being able to bring new money in to support these projects. I mean, what maybe still needs to be figured out there, because the SEC has not been as clear as some people would have liked.
Yeah. So in the clip that was shown earlier, Chair Gensler talked about kind of this four-pronged, you know, the Howey test, and reliant on the efforts of others being one of those four prongs to decide if something is a security or not. Where there's been a lot of confusion is there was a speech given by Director Hinman a few years ago, famous speech when Gary met Plastic, something like that. He said it is possible for something to be introduced as a security and then over time become decentralized or functional, and then it would no longer be a security. It would then be a commodity. So, okay, great. But what is that? And we still don't know what that looks like. In the meantime, we're seeing a significant amount of enforcement activity across the ecosystem, and all the lawyers are left to read the tea leaves to really understand what the rules to the road are. So this regulation by enforcement is not good for industry. It's not good for the SEC either. And ultimately, we need better clarity. We need a defined rules and regulations on when a token is a security and when it's not. The SEC has the jurisdiction to do that. Hester Peirce's safe harbor would be a great step in the right direction. Or Congress could pass a law, although that's a much larger feat to get accomplished to go through the legislative process.
Yeah, which could be a blessing and a curse, I suppose. You know, if SEC, if Gary Gensler's saying, look, you know, it's Congress, not us, that's going to ban crypto. You know, we've seen how hard it is for anything to get through Congress on the crypto front. So maybe that could be good. On the flip side, though, when you talk about why Congress now might care, though, it's because a lot of money, which would support jobs and other things in terms of growth here in the U.S., maybe getting locked out because of some of that confusion. And that's when they start to care. I mean, how big is that, though? How true is it that maybe some investment would get locked out or that these jobs would go overseas, seeing as a lot of them seem pretty specialized and as big as the market is, doesn't take a lot of developers, I suppose, to work on some of these things.
This is an unbelievably huge issue. Just 2 weeks ago, I attended the Digital Asset Summit in New York. It's one of the first time the industry really was able to get back together at an in-person conference. And I caught up with a lot of lawyers that I work with. And the number one thing that I was hearing from the legal community that is representing projects in this space is what they are spending their time on is helping American entrepreneurs who want to build in the cryptocurrency and the blockchain technology space structure their companies and their projects so they're completely geofenced outside of the US. How sad and completely disappointing is that, that an American entrepreneur can't offer their own products and services to people in the country they live on because they don't understand the rules to the road and they don't want to be out of compliance. This industry is a law-abiding industry. This industry is filled of really amazing people who want to follow the rules. It's not worth it to them to be outside of the law. And so they're just choosing to take their businesses elsewhere. This is a huge issue, and we cannot understate. And we need to take into account the opportunity cost of getting regulations wrong.
Yeah. In the meantime, it has been fascinating to watch kind of the price appreciation here in Bitcoin and Ether relative to some of those altcoins that had been high flyers. As we talk more about regulation, of course, Bitcoin and Ether have less questions when it comes to regulation, but interesting to watch. And Perry Ann Boring, Chamber of Digital Commerce founder and president, always love having you on. Appreciate you taking the time once again.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. I'm Jared Blickery. Private jet usage has taken off during the pandemic for at least one company. Jetit is now the first private aviation company that's licensed to operate in three separate geographic regions. And we have the CEO, co-founder of Jetit with us, Glenn Gonzalez. Glenn, thank you for joining us. And I just want you to give us an overview, not only of your company, but also the state of the industry. I know some of your competitors had some troubles early on. You seem to have been doing pretty well. And just tell us your company's story here.
Yeah, well, Jared, we started 3 years ago in 2018, just prior to the pandemic. We closed the end of last year with 9 airplanes. We're currently operating 15 aircraft. We have 6 more coming from Honda Aircraft Company. We're very excited about that. The industry as a whole has really taken on the mantle of there's an opportunity for us all here to succeed. The broader marketplace is following the premise that we started with at Jetit. Everyone is looking for more autonomy and efficiency and how they travel. And what we do is help people skip past the delays and the stops. You can travel with who you want. And when you're doing that at $1,600 an hour, those companies that are providing creativity and certainty to the broader marketplace are the ones that are succeeding. We've found our company, our revenues are up 5X over what they were last year. And we don't see an end in sight as it stands right now.
All right, so $1,600 an hour, definitely for the wealthy. But I know that there's been such great demand, and these folks are so awash with money right now, that some companies like yours are having trouble finding planes and finding pilots. Has that been the case for you at all?
It's definitely a struggle, and it's a struggle for the entire industry. In our particular case, we believe that our business model is well suited for everyone, not just the wealthy. At $1,600 an hour, when you have the access to the entire airplane, that's $400 a seat per hour. So the flight from New York to DC, the first class flights are going to be the same price. In addition to that, your time is so valuable. So if you're traveling to somewhere where the airlines have stopped their normal service, if you need to go see a loved one or if you need to close a business deal, there's really no way to compete with the service that we're offering. You take that a step further and you talk about it in the broader sense, the entire industry as a whole, yes, there are challenges finding flight crew, but by offering the opportunity to fly brand new airplanes to compensate our crew better, we have a crew concierge that exclusively takes care of our crew to make sure that they're happy, to provide a higher quality of life for them. We have not found a struggle as of yet to grow our workforce.
Well, Glenn, I got to ask you about the global energy crisis, as it may be related as well. We've seen fuel prices, at least jet fuel prices, surge 64% year to date. And I know your customers or your clients are somewhat wealthy. Maybe you can just pass those costs on to them. Correct me if I'm wrong, but have you faced situations where you literally cannot find the jet fuel that is needed to fuel your planes?
You know, there was a spell there over the summer where fuel shortages were a significant challenge. We have not experienced that since that point in time. In our case, it's a great hedge for our share owners, those individuals who are buying a piece of our airplanes. The $1,600 an hour does not change as the fuel prices change. We can, however, transfer that cost onto our charter customers, those individuals who are not willing to buy a share. So it works well in our favor in that we have inventory to sell additional shares into our program, but we also can transfer that cost. So we're a little bit insulated from fuel prices fluctuating aggressively, and our share owners are definitely protected from the prices going up.
Glenn, where do you stand in terms of electrifying your fleet? I know lots of private jet companies are looking to do that and looking to do it relatively quickly. How much of your fleet right now is electrified?
You know, we don't have any electric aircraft presently, but we have made a substantial order for aircraft with Bai Aerospace and the eFlyer 800. We believe that what we offer presently in the HondaJet is by far the most fuel efficient aircraft in the marketplace. So, but fuel prices, it's a variable cost that can fluctuate. And even though our business model is innovative, we also want to make sure that we can control those costs with the electrification. In addition to that, though, we focused on fuel efficiency with the HondaJet, but if we can neutralize our emissions in total by utilizing the eFlyer 800 and the electric aircraft, when those come about and they're certified, we expect that that's also important to us as an organization.
You know, when we take a look at the large carriers, we haven't really seen the resurgence in business travel. I know you cater to very special, wealthier clients. I'm just wondering if you're expecting to benefit as well from the general return to business usage of airplanes and flights.
You know, I think we'll all see it. Scott Kirby's the chairman CEO at United Airlines. He talks about it often that when you need to close that deal, Zoom works until you lose a deal. And we have found that our business owners, our entrepreneurs, small and medium-sized businesses that are traveling with us, they're still getting business accomplished and still closing deals. So we expect that trend to continue. That's the surge that we are all observing across the entire private aviation spectrum. And we just want to make sure that we are providing a consistent, high level of service and experience and certainty. If you ask for the airplane, it shows up when it's supposed to be there, so that you can get on and with your business and accomplish the goals for you, your family, your business, or your colleagues, whatever the case may be.
Well, Glenn, we thank you for stopping by here. That's Glenn Gonzalez, Jetit CEO and co-founder. Only minutes ago, Republican leader Mitch McConnell offered Democrats a short-term debt ceiling increase, one that will last through November, as he says, to give Democrats the time to pass a debt limit increase through the reconciliation process. And this comes only an hour after President Biden sat down with Secretary Yellen, as well as the CEOs of the NASDAQ, JP Morgan, and Citigroup, all of whom pleading with Congress to act urgently. And fortunately, we have Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland with us. And Senator, thank you for joining us today. I want to get your reaction to the situation as you sit across the aisle from McConnell and the Republicans here.
Well, Senator McConnell is playing an extremely dangerous game with the credit of the United States. We've indicated that the Democrats are prepared to increase the debt ceiling without the support of the Republicans. We just want them to allow us to take a vote. To go through reconciliation will take a long period of time, and then the uncertainty remains, which is not good for our market. At the end of the day, it's going to be the Democrats alone that looks like they're going to vote on the debt ceiling. So if that's the case, let us do it today. We have a bill that was sent over from the House that will allow us to raise the debt ceiling. Let's get it done. But the Republicans are blocking us from taking it up, running dangerously close to defaulting on our debt. But quite frankly, the later we wait, the more damage is being done. We know that there's a cost involved in uncertainty. So let's remove the uncertainty today.
Yeah, Senator, thank you so much for being with us. We know you have a very busy day. We saw the stock market actually start to bounce back once news of a possible deal between Senators McConnell and Schumer started to hit the wires. Do you happen to know the parameters of that deal yet?
I'm not certain there is a deal at this particular moment. Let's recognize what we're trying to do. It's not increasing government spending. We're just paying for which already has been spent. And that was done under Donald Trump's administration. And the Republicans and Democrats supported a lot of that new debt. So it's our responsibility to pay our bills right now. The simplest way for us to do it is to pass the bill that already passed the House. It's a simple extension of the debt ceiling till December of next year. Let's get that done now. Mitch McConnell has changed his mind six times. First, he says use budget reconciliation when he knows that's going to take us beyond the target date of a default. Now he's saying he'll give us a short-term extension. So while we can do that, knowing full well that it's going to be challenging for us to reconcile the House and Senate on the process he wants us to use, because the Republicans then can delay that. Any one senator can delay that process. Right now, we have a chance of getting it done. Stop playing games. Let us vote on the debt ceiling at this particular moment. It's already what we spent. It's the reputation and credit of the United States that's at stake.
Well, Senator, we've been through this before. I'm sure you have, too. And from my perspective, an outsider from D.C., this always seems to get resolved somehow at the last minute, usually not a market-moving event. But we have seen it do that. 10 years ago, S&P downgraded the debt of the United States, in part because of some of the horse trading that was going on there and the inaction. Is this something that we should really be – how concerned should we be that this isn't possibly resolved by the deadline that Janet Yellen has said is October 18th?
Well, there's many of us who would like to get rid of this ritual of raising the debt ceiling, since it is meaningless as far as the money that we're spending. It only can affect the cost of credit, not only to the government on the government bonds, but mortgages and interest rates on student loans. All that could be impacted by our failure to act timely on raising the debt ceiling. I expect we're going to get it done. I think we're going to get it done sooner rather than later. I think the Democrats are prepared to take whatever actions necessary to protect the credit of the United States of America. It's just very frustrating that the Republicans are delaying this and making us use extraordinary measures when we should have a simple vote on the debt ceiling on the floor now. We shouldn't be delaying it any longer. So Do I think that we will go into default? No, I think we'll get it done, but we shouldn't be doing the procedures right now that are delaying the action by the Senate.
Senator, I just want to ask you about the fate of the debt ceiling going forward. Treasury Secretary Yellen has gone on the record as saying she would support abolishing it. Today, we heard J.P. Morgan's CEO Jamie Dimon speaking from the White House there alongside President Biden, also throwing his support behind that idea. Would you be in favor of just getting rid of the debt ceiling?
Yes, absolutely. I think it is a situation where it doesn't have a check on our spending. It doesn't have an impact on where we spend our money. All it does is jeopardize the credit of the United States. The debt ceiling or the amount of debt we have is directly related to what we've authorized on spending and what we spend, not by raising the debt ceiling. So, yes, let's get rid of this. Let's eliminate this problem in the future. I'm all for that. We had a recommendation when I first got to Congress by then Congressman Gephardt that once we pass the bills, it automatically raises the debt ceiling, either that or get rid of it altogether.
Senator, I want to shift gears a little bit to a separate but related issue, and that is the vote on infrastructure that was supposed to take place late last week, did not happen. Can you give us an update on the status of that infrastructure bill?
Right. That bipartisan infrastructure bill that passed the Senate, it's going to pass the House. The president's going to sign it. The challenge is that we have two bills. The reconciliation budget is along with the bipartisan bill. Both need to get to the president's desk. We are in active negotiations as to the size and scope of the reconciliation budget. We expect to get that done within the next couple of weeks. Then I think you'll see both bills move and end up on the president's desk. But to me, it's clear that the infrastructure bill needs to pass and will pass.
And Senator, want to ask you quick about this spending plan. We expect it to be slimmed down a little bit, but the Federal Reserve has even said they think the economy is strong enough to stand on its own two feet, so much so that they're, you know, looking at now planning to roll back some of that pandemic era stimulus. Is it fiscally prudent to be spending trillions of dollars right now on all sorts of programs?
Well, I'm not sure we're going to be spending that by adding to the deficit of the country or heating up our economy. We're talking about offsetting, and I mean really offsetting, these expenses with revenues coming into the Treasury. So there will be an offset on the impact on our economy. I think if we use genuine offsets, that it minimizes the risk that you were referring to. So I can tell you we are committed to making sure that we pay for these programs.
As Senator, we certainly thank you for joining us today. Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland.
Power sports company Volcan making its public debut today. And take a look at this chart. Shares are surging in its first day of trading, up just over 110%. The company listing on the NASDAQ today. So we want to bring in Volcan CEO Jordan Davis. We're also joined by Yahoo Finance reporter Pras Subramanian. Jordan, that move in the stock today, 110% gain that we're seeing, clearly congratulations on what is an exciting day for you. But what do you make of the enthusiasm that we're seeing from the street today?
Well, thank you for having me. Yes, we're very excited about this. You know, I think the enthusiasm comes from just a general enthusiasm for EV. You know, there's a big appetite for the various EV competitors out there. And I think the fact that we are 100% off-road EV power sport company and the only one listed on the NASDAQ just adds a little bit of excitement as well.
Hey, Jordan, Pras here, and congrats again on today's debut. So how big do you think the market is for electric power sports vehicles? And what kind of pre-order interest are you guys seeing so far?
So I think the market is healthy. I couldn't comment on the total, you know, volume. We see early demand as being very strong. We've been pre-selling vehicles now for quite a few months, and we have pre-orders of roughly 270 fully paid pre-orders. We continue to get a lot of feedback from both the marketplace and potential dealers about the excitement for the space and commentary around things like from the dealer base. We know that this is going to be a big chunk of the market. You know, I think that there's it used to be a perception that the EV technologies were emerging, right? But I think we're at a point now where EV technology is an accepted technology, especially in the vehicle space. So we think there's a very big appetite from the consumer for vehicles, both two wheel and four.
A lot of us love anything with wheels. And I have to ask you, I'm looking at the website right now, the 2022 Volcan Grunt. When we look at a vehicle like this, I would imagine that you're saving in the production of it because you don't have all the gears and all the components that an internal combustion type vehicle has. But the price, at least online, of $79.95, I mean, $7,900, does that put you out of the market for a lot of us who would love something like this?
You know, we don't think so. When we look at the competitive landscape, and there are other motorcycles, EV motorcycles out there, we actually under-index at our MSRP. So we think we're very competitive. Some of the other features that we offer on the bike are things that you're not going to get in a substitute product like a combustion engine bike. So we will be releasing a app, for instance, that is linked to the motorcycle that gives you on the fly tuning capabilities, navigation. It serves as your interactive dashboard. And we have a roadmap for that product that's going to offer other cool features for the user at the end of the day. So, you know, we go back to your comment about the complexity of build or the non-complexity of build. Yes, there's far fewer parts. You know, our bike has between 150 and 170 parts compared to the possible thousands that go into an internal combustion bike. But I think when you look at the fact that a customer doesn't have to change oil, change a spark plug, do any kind of technical work to the bike, that adds to the convenience and that adds to what customers are willing to pay to have something that's both easy to ride and low maintenance and over the course of ownership, a pretty low cost of ownership.
Hey, Jordan, so you guys are based in Austin, Texas, building the bikes there. Are you guys committed to U.S.-based manufacturing? And so far, have you guys had any problems with component shortages and things like that?
Yeah, so we are proud to be in Texas, and we're proud to be built in the USA. One of the things that we are focused on is to continue production in Texas and try to source as many components domestically as possible. Our bikes do have components from global supply chain, but as far as the continuity goes, we've been able to manage that very well. Now we are facing the same supply chain shortages as the big three auto manufacturers, our own competitors in the power sports marketplace. There's no hiding from that right now, but we've got a really seasoned team. Experienced team, and they've been able to navigate that well and keep us in parts.
Jordan, going off of that, I mean, have you had to change your strategy at all? I would imagine that maybe some things have been delayed as a result of the supply chain issues that you're not alone on it, but that the industry is facing at large.
So I think our strategy has remained the same from day one, which is to be a market leader in the space, and definitely the EV power sports leader eventually. As far as our distribution strategy goes, we have made some evolutions over the last few months, mostly so that we're able to scale in the future and keep up with demand while being profitable and delivering the product. So, early on, we were focused on 100% direct consumer model. And we continue to operate that way. We've actually been making deliveries now for about 3 weeks to consumers. We kicked that off on September 10th. We've also made some initial deliveries to retail. But going forward, we see a lot of value in partnering with the power sports dealership community and network, especially in the United States. It's well established. It's got a good track record of servicing customers and being able to provide an environment where they can test and see product and then have some place to go back to if they need, accessories or service or any number of touch points. So as far as our corporate strategy goes, we really haven't pivoted there. But as far as distribution, yeah, we've taken a step back and looked at what makes more sense going forward.
All right, Jordan Davis, congratulations again. A big day for your company, CEO of Volcon. And of course, our thanks to Pras Subramanian as well.